Continue on with the music.
Wind up the volume.
Let's dance.
You're on 107.3. This is 2SCR.
Good morning. You are tuned in to 2SCR 107.3. Now, my name is Andrew Popel, and every week I get to talk to you about books, writing, and literary culture. The show is called Final Draft, and look, the last couple of weeks we've had a bit of a winter hibernation. Every so often I need to catch up on my reading. I wasn't in Sydney, so you got to have a recap, a reprise, an encore performance of some great conversations, but I am back. And I have got two fabulous conversations for you today. It is Sydney Jewish Writers Festival this weekend. And so coming up on the show, I have a conversation with Ginger Gorman. Ginger will be appearing at the festival in conversation with Kerry Sackville. And Ginger's book that came out in February this year is Troll Hunting. It is a deep dive, a fantastic investigative journalism look at trolls, the online world of trolls, and the way trolling and online activity is actually a real world thing with real world harms. It is a fabulous conversation. I will let you know it is also a full on conversation, and we do discuss a lot of the way these harms enter into the real world. So I really encourage you to have a listen, but just be aware if you do have sensitive ears in the room. I also, coming up first on the show, is a fantastic new YA novel. It is a Daboon novel from Helena Fox. The novel is called How It Feels to Float, and it looks at the experience of a young girl and the way sort of things fall out when she's ostracized from her social group, but it also deals with mental health and mental illness. And look, I cannot recommend both of these books highly enough, but it is also going to be a couple of full-on conversations today. So be aware and just know that help is out there if these conversations bring up anything for you. Lifeline is available on 131114. I'm going to repeat that number throughout the show. But Ginger Gorman's Troll Hunting and Helena Fox's How It Feels to Float are what you have to look forward to here on Final Draft. It's just going to be after this very short message.
Explore the early musical experiences of European settlers in the new exhibition, Songs of Home, now on at the Museum of Sydney. Discover the cultural exchanges between early Indigenous and European musicians, learn about Australia's first piano, and take a glimpse at some of the period's rarest instruments. To top it all off, enjoy specially commissioned new works by Indigenous composers to bring the exhibition into the contemporary world. Sponsors of 2SER.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel. And right now, I am joined in the studio by Helena Fox. Helena is a writer who runs writing workshops and mentors young writers. And she's joining me today to discuss her debut novel, How It Feels to Float. Helena, welcome. Welcome to the 2SER studios.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you so much for having me.
It is great to have you here. And it's great to be discussing this book for so many reasons that we're going to get into. But this is a book that I think has really moved me. I often introduce books like this as the embarrassing ones where I'm turning my head in cafes because of like teary moments. Yeah. And we may even get into why maybe I should be just, you know, crying openly about books like this. But How It Feels to Float, it welcomes us into the life of Elizabeth Martin Gray, or just Biz, because no one she loves would call her by her full name. Biz lives near the beach in Wollongong with her mum and her twin brother and sister. She's got her posse at school. She's got her best friend, Grace. She's also got a dad, and they talk often. The only thing is, Biz's dad died when she was 7, so she can't exactly tell anyone about these conversations. And How It Feels to Float, it takes us through some wonderful but also truly terrible moments in Biz's young life. So I thought I'm going to start by giving a call out, because we are going to be discussing mental health. We're also going to be discussing mental health difficulties. So if there's anyone out there listening that feels like this might be a concern for them, they may want to tune down the interview, but also please know that help is available. You can call Lifeline 24 hours a day on 131114. And you can also reach Headspace on 1800 650 890. There are also a stack of great resources online through places like Beyond Blue that you can Google. But let's get into How It Feels to Float, because while these issues are difficult, I think you'll agree, Helena, they're so important to talk about.
Yeah, I think it is probably one of the things I feel most strongly about and most passionate about, is talking very openly about mental health issues and talking about how you make your way through them and how you can find hope as you're dealing with those situations.
Mm. So through reading the book, I came to know Biz pretty well. Mm. And I developed this real affection for what is just a beautifully drawn character. I've already mentioned that the book explores some pretty terrible moments in her life, but can we start with Biz as you know her? Tell us a little bit about how her voice came to you.
Okay. Well, Biz has become probably one of my closest imaginary friends. She came to me about 8 years ago as just a voice stepping in and talking about my photographs, actually, as though they were hers. And she just appeared in these snatches and fragments and glimpses. For example, there was a photograph of mine of my dog, and this voice came in saying, this is the dog. He's wondering why I keep stopping, why I keep holding that box up everywhere. Don't I know about the pigeons that need chasing? And that was a glimpse. And then I had another one that was just dappled light on a slide in a playground, and other kind of random fragmenty photographs. And this voice said, oh, these are portrait of my family, is what she called it. And then I started writing into that voice and finding out more about this girl who quickly I found out that she was quite interested in quantum physics and dealing with clinical depression, quite lonely, quite floaty, and really quite dedicated to the idea of bringing back her disappeared father, who at the time that I was exploring it, was he had gone somewhere, and she wanted to use her photographs to try and bring him back in some way, because she felt that those photographs spoke to her. So that was those were the ideas I had, and then I wasn't quite sure what to do with her at that point. So I wanted to do her story justice, and I knew that I cared about her very much. So I waited, actually, for the story to be just right for me to feel ready to write her story. And so she just kind of grew and built in kind of inside my head over the years. And I went through some really difficult times of my own. Mm. I also wrote two other novel manuscripts. And then at some point about 2 years ago, Biz just kind of walked into this cafe where I was working on another project and basically plonked herself down and said, it's time to write my story. And over the course of writing about her, I realized how intertwined our stories were, where she would have an experience that was different from mine, but I would bring in my own experiences into that. So, for example, dissociation and, delayed trauma and how grief can upend you. And so those are things that I know. And so I kind of just walked with Biz, and the way that I would describe her is as this kind of irreverent, deeply funny, curious, vulnerable girl. There's someone who loves people dearly but doesn't really know why she's staying or how to stay upright when so much keeps coming to upend her.
Mm. So Biz lives down in Wollongong, only an hour and a half down the road from where we are. I grew up with Sydney's beach culture, and as I read How It Feels to Float, it occurred to me that from a certain perspective, Biz and her friends might look like pretty typical teenagers, and also that this view is a perfectly ignorant and grown-up way of diminishing the ways that young adults, they negotiate their way into a world, that it never looks the same as it did for their parents a generation earlier. But we sort of go, oh, well, it looks like what we went through. Mm. What did you want readers to see in Biz and in her peer group?
Well, I think there's two things. There is what young people are living with now and how very unique that is in this day and age, what they're dealing with. And there's also that universal, here we are, we have been to parties at the beach, we've gotten drunk there. Not all of us, obviously, but there's a lot of young people who have. And, we look back in our memories and go, yeah, there was that time we did that. And there was that time we were confused, that there was that time we kissed someone who didn't love us back. So those are kind of universal growing up experiences. But I think where one of the ways in which I think Biz is unique and possibly with her friends is that there's more, there's, I think, of two ways. One is that Biz is quite concerned about, you know, how the earth is kind of disintegrating. You know, she's worried about plastic choking the turtles and the islands getting covered because of climate change. And those are things that kind of feed through her conversations with herself. And then there's also, I think, a new opening up of language about sexual identity that we certainly didn't have, or I certainly didn't have in with my school peers, where when Biz is trying to figure out who she loves, who she's attracted to, and she's talking with her best friend, Grace, Grace is asking her, are you bi or all the way gay? Because if you're this, I could set you up with this girl. And if you're that, I could set you up with this boy. And also just kind of a digging into wanting to know Biz's sexual identity, which I think I don't remember people having those conversations when I was at school. Like, you know, it just seemed so foreign then and so taboo then and such the butt of the joke then to be anything but heterosexual. And so now I feel like there's a much more nuanced conversation happening about sexual identity and hopefully a movement into greater understanding and greater acceptance of the huge spectrum of sexual identity that young people and all of us experience.
I want to give a little bit more context to Biz's story and get into that, because there is so much to discuss. I know I have to leave something, quite a lot, for the reader to discover. But I thought I want to highlight a scene that's early in the novel, and it's a catalyst for so much of what goes on and happens to Biz. So after attending a party on the beach, Biz says no to a boy that she's hooking up with. He then goes on to lie about the incident, and her group of friends, as well as the boys, gaslight her and ostracize her, not only from their friendship, but also within the school. So gaslighting is this topic that as a society, I feel like we still struggle to understand, we struggle to take seriously. But can you tell me about the interactions in the novel and what they meant to Biz?
I think a lot of what happens on that beach come from her questioning self. And I think in a perfect world, we get to question, we get to try things out. We get to experiment with boys and girls or being non-binary. We get to feel into our identities with no judgment in a perfect world. And Biz is thinking, well, if I have sex with this guy, I can be normal. And things unravel from there. And what she's met with is not compassion. She's not met with any kind of kindness. And I think that's what we're dealing with still today, unfortunately, is that as we step into our identities, there's still so much you're different, and why aren't you fitting in? Why aren't you swimming with us the way that we swim? And so I think a lot of what I hear happening at schools and have seen myself is just kind of that not wanting to ripple the pond, just wanting to be safe by being the same.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Helena.
Thank you.
I am speaking with Helena Fox. We are discussing How It Feels to Float. It's her debut novel. And we've discussed some really difficult themes, or themes that people do find difficult, around mental health and around mental health and mental illness. So I just want to mention a couple of numbers again, because if you are struggling with these things, know that help is available. You can call Lifeline on 131114. Headspace is on 1-800-650-890. And I Googled and was on the Beyond Blue site. And
that's a great site.
They've got so many more. There are people you can chat to online. So if this conversation has brought anything up, if reading a fantastic book still brings things for you, then know that help is out there. And Helena, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to have this chat.
Thank you so much for having me.
Be inspired by in-depth interviews with some of Australia's leading journalists. Meet the Journalists is a public series of events where current journalism students interview some of your favourite speakers and writers. You can share in this experience too by listening to the podcast or attending the live events in person. Meet the Journalists' latest season includes David Spears, Fran Kelly, Richard Cook and Emma Alberici. Google UTS Meet the Journalists to find out more. UTS School of Communication sponsors 2SER.
You're tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You are listening to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. Now, I'm joined on the line by Ginger Gorman. Ginger is an award-winning print, online, and radio journalist. Her work has featured, well, look, can I just say that if you bring up a graphic of all the outlets Ginger's work has featured on, it's sort of like a media subscription service. There's BBC, there's ABC, SMH, Triple J. There are some that even have full words, not just letters. But for many people, Ginger's name will be known for the book Troll Hunting. It was published earlier this year, and Troll Hunting delves into the world of online trolls and the ways their activities shape the digital and in real life lives that we lead. Ginger, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
And, of course, we are chatting ahead of your appearance this weekend at the Sydney Jewish Writers Festival, where you're going to be in conversation with Kerry Sackville. That's on Sunday, and it's down at Bondi Pavilion. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention to people that they can get tickets at shalom.edu.au, or if you just search Sydney Jewish Writers Festival, you'll be able to find out all of that info. But are we going to give a preview of what you're going to be in conversation about? And, of course, it is this incredible book, Troll Hunting. And, look, you're on Final Draft, and book-loving bunch that we are, we're probably at this strange intersection of analog and digital. And in reading Troll Hunting, I thought it's going to be really important to clarify some of the terms that will come up in the conversation. Of course, the web is a linguistic wonderland, and it can be really hard to pin down terms in their real-time usage. But can you try and help us get a handle on things like trolls and trolling, predator trolling and technology facilitated abuse that can look really similar but have these subtle distinctions?
Yes, so one of the things I did realise when I started writing the book is that the word troll is used in such a broad context now that it almost has no meaning. So, for example, people will call Donald Trump a troll. I was teasing my daughter about something she was eating and my husband said, "You're trolling her." You know, so we use it in a way that it is almost meaningless. However, what I started researching was very, very extreme cyber hate, which I came to call predator trolling. So what I mean by predator trolling is extreme cyber hate that does real life harm, and it might be perpetrated by one or more people against a victim. Now, that's the extreme end. The other end is, of course, you know, really light pranks, things like Rickrolling, where you accidentally click on a link and it's Rick Astley's song, Never Gonna Give You Up. So some trolling is very lighthearted and funny, and some trolling has a social purpose. For example, I saw some really interesting trolling of Pauline Hanson the other day around, you know, she was calling people to tell stories of how, as white people, they had been subject to racism. And people were really just making fun of that online in quite a hilarious way, but it had a social purpose. So I would never say that some trolling isn't useful and some trolling isn't funny, but at that extreme end, you know, we get things like the Christchurch massacre. So that guy was a predator troll. And that guy is the kind of guy in my book. And that real life harm is happening, you know, daily. It's happening all the time. So my book links predator trolling to murder, to domestic violence, to terrorism, to real life stalking, to assault. So very serious crimes.
And the way these terms can sometimes seem amorphous, sometimes seem to be shifting, it seems to me also at the heart of why it can be so hard to get a handle on things and the ways that trolling can be dismissed when maybe it shouldn't be. But I mean, even having a sense of what trolls do can also belie the visceral horror of their attacks. And I know this is a story that is both incredibly difficult for you, but also that you've obviously had to retell many times. But can you give us a sense of what trolling looks like and how this whole process started for you?
Well, so I worked for the ABC for many, many years, nearly two decades, and essentially as a result of something that I had published and broadcast on the ABC, back in 2013, I became subject to an orchestrated online hate campaign. And so I was actually on maternity leave with my second daughter when that hatred started rolling in on social media. And it was just completely terrifying. So I got a death threat. We got a death threat. And we also had a picture of our family posted onto a fascist website and lots of foul commentary around that. And the combination of those things together was particularly terrifying because my mum's family fled the Holocaust and they were, in fact, survivors of that. And some of those family members did perish in the Holocaust. So the death threat coupled with the fascist website and our family photo on there was really terrifying. And the thing that I remember is just really lying in bed late at night and listening to my little babies asleep in the next room, breathing and thinking, you know, did I just put my kids' lives at risk because of my job as a journalist? So that's where it really started for me. I didn't know anything about trolling before that. I'm not a techie person. I was never particularly interested in the internet. But that moment of pure fear really made me understand how scary it could be. And, I mean, luckily for our family, it did die down and we haven't actually been subject to physical violence, but lots of journalists are. You know, there's a woman in my book, a journalist called Sherelle Moody. She is not just a journalist but an anti-family violence campaigner. And the cyber hate she's subject to is extreme. And in the course of when I was writing my book, she wrote to me and said, my horse has just been threatened. Someone said they're going to kill my horse. And they did kill her horse. And so her dog was also given acid and poisoned, and her dog lived. But you can see that these harms don't stay online, basically. They cause real-life harm. And so the idea that this stuff happens in fairyland, in this virtual space online, and we should just pull our big girl panties up is ludicrous.
So we have this culture that's shaping, and as well as troll hunting, you've also contributed to the collection Me Too Stories from the Australian Movement. And in that discussion, as in troll hunting, you note the parallels between the treatment of victims of online abuse and historically the treatment of domestic violence, particularly, this view that it's somehow a private matter. There's a failure to understand where jurisdiction lies. I wondered what you thought about how power, how privilege and misogyny intersect in the behaviours and the treatment of trolls and also their victims when their victims come forward.
Well, so these are really complex questions, Andrew, and I'm glad you've asked them, but they're not that easy to unpick. So the first thing is that with domestic violence targets or survivors, there is almost 100% crossover with what they call tech abuse in the sector. Now, this is partly a language problem because a lot of tech abuse is actually just predator trolling. So it's like extreme cyber hate against your former partner, which ruins their lives. And, you know, there's a couple of case studies in my book where, you know, one of the women in particular has tried to suicide because of it, because this man has just completely destroyed her. And a lot of it has happened online. So he's really, you know, ruined her reputation, made her unemployable. She lives in a small town and so forth. These things are very much related to misogyny and domestic violence. And at the moment, I'm reading Jess Hill's fabulous book, See What You Made Me Do, and you can see a lot of these threads are the same in that book. The outright trolls that I have interviewed really do express that they are angry that their privileges as sort of white males are being taken away from them. And they blame feminism and women for that. And so a lot of what they are expressing, particularly towards white women, but also to women of colour online, is that anger.
So in considering this, I started to have a really uncomfortable sense of my own online existence. And I'm sure there are people listening and in your readership who are wondering whether they should be more aware of their digital footprint and what it looks like and who has access to it. But then I thought, if we change our behaviours, does that mean the trolls win? And I just wondered, do you have any insights? Is this something you're still working through around how we reconcile ourselves in whatever we come to call the real and online world? Because it's useless to separate them, as we've already discussed.
Look, these are hard questions. And me, for example, my digital footprint is such a mess, I could never clean it up because, for example, there's pictures of my family and articles I've written and so forth. I don't actually think this is really up to individuals to keep themselves safe. I don't think it's up to victims to sort this out. This is like saying, you know, domestic violence victims, what did you do to make the person violent towards you? I believe the structures of society that exist offline to keep us safe need to exist online. So the police, law enforcement need to do a lot better, but also the social media companies are an abomination. They, you know, pay almost no tax. They make billions of dollars from our data. They have been whining about fixing social media since 2006 and fixing cyber hate, and they don't. And the reason that they don't is because it doesn't suit their revenue model. So when there's a cyber hate event, they make more money. You know, like I went to Facebook a year ago and said this is Facebook Live isn't safe. They told me it was. And then, you know, the Christchurch massacre obviously was broadcast on Facebook Live. So it's not safe. So the thing is, like, I don't feel like we as individuals need to change except maybe to be kinder online. It's really that these structures to keep us safe need to be better.
These issues are discussed in Troll Hunting, and I am discussing them with the author of Troll Hunting, Ginger Gorman. She also appears in the collection Me Too Stories from the Australian Movement. And Ginger's going to be at the Sydney Jewish Writers Festival at Bondi Pavilion on Sunday, August 25th, that's this weekend. Tickets and info are available from shalom.edu.au. And Ginger, I just wanted to end because you're going to be on stage. You're going to be talking about your book with Kerry Sackville. I wondered what for you the contrast is like now between online interactions and when you get to appear before people discussing the same topics.
Oh, that's a hard question. I don't think I've been asked that before. Look, I never expected the book to have such traction. Like, I wrote the book crying in my pajamas in Canberra, you know, and drinking a lot. And I got PTSD and depression from it. And I did a specialised course of therapy in order to be able to face the public and face the media, because I do not want people to die because of what happens online. But it's just incredible to me, the interest. Like, I'm a bit overwhelmed by it, and I'm so heartened by it. Like, I know that, for example, the Iranian writer Bruce Sultani is reading my book on Mammoth Island. I know that a head of a major media company in the Philippines is getting outrageously attacked is reading it there. I know that the deputy editor of Times India is reading it because trolling is so bad in that country. It's being read in Sri Lanka. You know, it's just being read all over the world, and I never imagined that. And I think the public is really saying to me, you know, we care about this, we want this to be better, this has to change. So that's incredible, you know, that we're almost starting a movement.
I think it is a conversation that we were probably too late in starting, but thank goodness we're having it now.
Thank you, and thank you for being part of the conversation too, Andrew.
Thanks, Ginger. You are on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and this is Final Draft, Books, Writing and Literary Culture. That was Ginger Gorman just there, and we were discussing her book Troll Hunting. We were discussing the impact of online troll activity, the way that the in-real-life world and the online world, really, they blur across each other, and these impacts are real and they are serious. If that conversation brought up anything for you, if you are having a tough time with anything, I'm going to mention the Lifeline number again. We have mentioned it a couple of times in this episode, and it is important to know that help is out there if you are going through a tough time. Now, that number is 131114. Ginger is, of course, appearing at the Sydney Jewish Writers Festival. That is on this weekend. For information, you can go to shalom.edu.au. That's shalom.edu.au. Or just Google Sydney Jewish Writers Festival. Now, I had two amazing conversations today, so I want to shout out to Helena Fox. And she came in and we discussed how it feels to float her debut novel. I don't always get enough time to have the full conversation on air, though. So I want to point you towards the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. If you would like to hear more from Helena, if you would like to hear more from Ginger, both of those conversations are going up online after the show, and you can get more, you can discover more about troll hunting, about the work that Ginger did, the absolute fantastic investigative journalism that went into troll hunting. Just go to wherever you get your podcasts and search Final Draft. Great conversations. If you subscribe, that means you get a new one every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. I will be back next week with more Final Draft. Shout out to The Vulture's Nest. They are coming up next with their take on the week in news and events. My name is Andrew Popel. I'm going to say bye for now. I'll be back next week. Until then, happy reading.